From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of storytellers and documentaries, and today it's a couple of stories featuring people in uniform. Whether it's a group of security guards lost in their own thoughts, or in the second half of the program, police officers who put on a different set of uniforms for a no-holds-barred grudge match with the national champions of dwarf basketball. We begin with a story from Sofia Saldana, a Portuguese radio producer now living in London, and this radio piece won her the Best New Artist Award at the 2010 Third Coast International Audio Festival. It's called The Sleeping Fool.
If you have something else going on in your life, things that you have to do, I think working as a care assistant is really helpful, because sometimes in this city you struggle to have the time, to find time to think.
The job I do is to protect the works of art, to be in the rooms, to give advice, guidance, directions to members of the public. My name is Russell Carr and I'm a gallery assistant at Tate Britain.
It's a job that is easy to do, especially if you've got something else to do it. Like, I do my photography and I try to persuade a career as a photographer. So that is a job that it pays, you know, not much, but it helps with the bills and it gives me time and freedom to do my own work.
My name is Suzette Almeida and I've been in the Tate for 8 years now, working as a gallery assistant.
Well, if I do more than 3 days, for instance, today is my third day in the week and I'm starting to feel a little bit like, oof, it's a bit too much now, because my week is already organized and I know what I have to do, so I just need to do it. So I feel like a bit trapped today. My name is Paula Guicochea Perez and I'm a gallery assistant at Tate Britain.
My name is Robert Reynard and I'm a gallery assistant at Tate Britain.
Tony.
My name is Nivek Amichand and I'm a gallery assistant.
First thing in the morning, when there's hardly anyone here, I found it really peaceful and restful, and it's nice having the paintings around you.
It's a very easy job, so you just have to turn up and literally just walk around. I've got lots of friends here, some close kind of relationships with people. It doesn't always feel like a job. There are problems sometimes with things like evacuations or suspect bags, but for the most part, it's a relatively easy job.
An art gallery is an art environment, so you don't have to be strict. You know, it's an open thing. You interact with the people, you speak with the people. It's not like years ago that the role of a gallery assistant was to stay in one room and you couldn't speak, you couldn't, you know, even talk to the visitors.
You often get normally American people that will come up and just bark questions at you without perhaps an introduction of hello or how are you. But you also get a certain class of English person that might come up and say, where are the toilets? Or something like that. They would bark something at you. And I always try to say, well, first of all, good morning, or try to kind of bring them back into a civilized form of behavior. But they are a minority.
When you're working as a gallery assistant, you put on the uniform and you become invisible. People don't tend not to see you. They tend to give you less respect. They tend to speak down to you because they think you are less educated, because you're doing a job that's not highly skilled. But at the same time, yeah, it's just that you feel less valued as a person because you're working in a job that's... I know lots of people have been doing it for a long time, but you get treated not like you should be treated as a person.
I suppose if you're having problems in your personal life or if you're worried about something, you've got lots of time to think and dwell on things. So if something was bothering you, you can just imagine the worst.
Yeah, everything is a lot bigger than it seems because you've got nothing better to do and you're not allowed to talk. So you end up thinking about, if you have a small problem, it gets blown up into a massive problem because your mind keeps on playing on it over and over again. If you're tired, you just get more grumpy. If you're happy, the day tends to go by a bit quicker. Your concept of time, I think, changes when your mind is in a different place.
Oh, well, that's totally the opposite for me. When you are surrounded by artwork that you like, that is more likely for me to ease the problem, you know, in a way. But it certainly doesn't amplify it.
It's fun. It's good fun to be there. And it's good that we're surrounded by the works of art and it can inspire us, particularly my work, if I want to, you know, give me some inspiration. But at the end of the day, it's a job. It's a, you know, 8-hour job. And who likes to do it? I don't.
Today I was thinking of going to Sardinia, and I've never been there before, so I was just having my own trip, you know. I was thinking about going to camping, I was thinking of going with my girl. I was just imagining myself being there, you know, with a camera on my hand, a Super 8, and having sex on the night. Yeah. This girl, this colleague of mine, I was just imagining looking at her, just standing on the sand, you know, just standing on the beach, with no talking, with no sounds, just looking.
I think about Spain, Salamanca. I think about the cathedral and the bridges over the river. I'm sitting outside the cafe and having a very nice cup of tea or coffee and an ice cream. I always buy ice creams when I go to Salamanca.
If I see a visitor that looks interesting, or if I see a beautiful girl or a woman, then you sort of you concentrate on that person. Or even the artwork, if you can look at a painting and, I don't know, imagine what it must have been like to have lived in those times. This week I was working in the early British section. So you've got the costumes there and certain historical or mythological situations. You start to think about those. Yeah, I mean, I suppose the paintings and the women, that's what you think about. I don't ever think I imagine myself within a painting. I imagine the scenes and what action might be unfolding within that painting. I was looking at a Fuseli painting quite a lot this week, the Midsummer Night's Dream one with Titania and Bottom. There's some weird things going on in there. But what I'd be doing, I don't know. I don't know.
In the painting, I see myself standing on what seems to be a very small planet, and there is a harp. The harp only has one chord, which is a symbol of very little hope in the life of the character who is playing or who is touching the chord. But as long as there is one chord, there is hope. When I feel a bit down, I just imagine being in the place of this character. You have to believe in what seems to be hopeless situation, which seems to be going badly, can be changed if you really believe it.
If I have to choose a situation, I think I wouldn't mind to be in one of those Francis Bacon stage. I would like to have sex with one of those ex-Francis Bacon's boyfriends, probably Dreyer, and get really high on drugs. And Francis Bacon basically is looking at us. He comes into the stage, he comes into the picture. Francis Bacon comes in, doesn't talk to us. It just comes through. It's like passing through the painting, no? He's like, shoof. He looks at us because I'm with his boyfriend or ex-boyfriend. And I'm just about, or probably I have sex already, or I'm just about to have sex with him. And he knows that the situation is quite tense, you know, violent. Someone has to die. I don't know if it's me or Bacon or maybe not dying, but I would like to see a fight. And then some chairs in the air and some yelling and shouting and glasses broken on the floor and the bottle of whiskey. I think I'd like to have one of those experiences.
I'll be the sleeping cool, because you don't have to worry about anything. You're just innocent. You're just sleeping, letting everything go past you. And you don't have to worry about the world. Yeah, I'd be the sleeping fool, definitely.
The Sleeping Fool was produced by Sophia Saldana. Coming up, a man combines a monkey, some cops, and a dwarf basketball team all to raise money for Hurricane Katrina victims. If that sounds like a recipe for disaster to you, you could not be more right. I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional on KCRW and KCRW.com. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW and KCRW.com. My name is Bob Carlson, and this week's episode is called In Uniform. Today's second story comes from Shane Conrad. He's a sometimes deputy sheriff, sometimes actor and producer, sometime basketball player. He's also the son of famed actor Robert Conrad, and the story begins with what seems like a brilliant idea. And since this is Los Angeles, the idea comes to him in his attorney's office.
Quite a few years ago, I was in my attorney's office, my entertainment attorney's office, talking about kind of my career or a lack thereof. My attorney's like, look, you should do something that you like and that you know. I thought, okay, what are just a few things that I think I could create a show around that would be entertaining to me? Well, I've got some police expertise. You know, at the time I was a reserve deputy sheriff for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department for 4 years. I still am. I've always loved monkeys. And whenever there's a show or a movie really about a monkey, I'll see it. And then the third element was to work with a little person, a dwarf. I've always felt like dwarfs are underrepresented in the entertainment industry. And I feel like whenever they're working in shows, they're always either evil dwarfs or strange dwarfs, like in The Wizard of Oz. Dwarfs have always kind of intrigued me. And I think it probably stems back from my father had a television series on in the 60s called The Wild Wild West. And they had a recurring character on that show called Dr. Lovelace. And Dr. Lovelace was kind of like this evil genius that was always trying to bury my dad.
Now don't spoil it, Mr. West. You're so impulsive. Now here we are, two old friends who haven't seen each other for such a long time, and you want to fight right off. I, for one, am overjoyed to see you. So much so that perhaps I shan't even kill you right at this moment. I'll wait 10 seconds or so, perhaps. Time enough for me to sit here and enjoy your company. 10 precious seconds.
And I remember watching my dad's shows and being like, wow, this dwarf's cool and he's evil. And he looks like me because he's kind of the same size as me, but he's a man. So I write up a treatment, and then I contact my attorney, and I'm like, look, I think I've got something pretty solid. It's a crime procedural, unscripted, about a cop, a dwarf, and a monkey. And I'm like, we're going to work together as a team, and we're going to solve crimes. He was like, I have to tell you, it's pretty awesome. He's like, I love it. He's like, let's set a meeting for you. So he and his partner set a meeting for me at National Lampoon in Los Angeles. And I pitched these guys. They're like, we're down. We love it. This is in our wheelhouse. Dwarfs, monkeys. We get it. We're not totally sure about the cop angle. We're not totally sure about you. But we like the idea. And then we hold auditions for little people at my attorney's offices in Santa Monica. And so I'm meeting all these guys. And in the course of these meetings, I met this one actor named Martin Kleba, who had recently starred in a TV movie for Comedy Central called Knee High P.I.
Well, who is it?
Somebody out there. This is watermelon.
That's the biggest watermelon I've ever seen.
it.
Hank Dingo, Private Eye. Looks like you just bit off more than you could chew. Not exactly what you had in rind, was it?
Marty's a cool dude. Got a shaved head. He drives a Corvette. Works out like crazy. I mean, the guy's in far better shape than I am. We just hit it off, and I'm like, okay, this is the guy. So Marty and I start production on this project, which is called Gordo's Roadshow, named after, of course, the monkey.
What's the city, Marty? Where are we going?
We're going to Van Nuys, California.
I can't drive any. Keep the monkey on your lap, please!
Don't raise your voice. You're going to scare him.
I don't see a little wheel and some little pedals over there, okay? So why don't you let me do the driving?
Why don't you let me drive?
I start working with Marty, great guy. And we start talking, and he's like, yeah, you should see our dwarf basketball team at some point. What are you talking about, dwarf basketball team? Yeah, he's like, we're called the LA Breakers. And he's like, we're an all-little-person basketball team, and they play in the Dwarf Athletic Association of America. This thing sounded awesome. I looked at their website, the tallest guy being, you know, maybe 4'10", and the smallest guy being no taller than 2.5 feet tall. So Marty says, you guys should come see us play. They were playing to a packed high school auditorium. They were playing the school faculty. And there were a couple of interesting things about the game that leveled the playing field. Number one, you have to bounce pass if you're a regular-sized person. All passes have to hit the ground. And you are not allowed to get a rebound until it hits the ground. And it was kind of like Harlem Globetrotter style. So I watched these guys play their game, and the little person team wins, the LA Breakers. All these kids are going crazy. They're going up to get their autographs. And I'm like, I got to get into this. Somehow, some way, I need to play these guys. And I thought, let's do this with the sheriff's department. Marty says, we'd love to play some cops. You know, he's like, we'd love to, I think his word is, we'd love to beat some ass on some coppers, is what he said. I start to put it together, which proved to be a little bit more challenging than I first thought. And so finally, like days before the game, I got a call back from one of the captains at the station I was working at to say, hey, call this guy. He's one of our star basketball players, and he'll hook you up. So I call this deputy sheriff. Of course, he thinks I'm messing with him. But as I tell him more about it, he's like, I'll gather some guys. I managed to pull some other friends I know. So bam, we got our team. And right about this time, Katrina hits down in New Orleans. So I'm like, okay, this is a good opportunity for us to help Katrina victims. We'll have like a food drive and clothing drive. We'll also charge $8 to have people watch that will donate to the LA Breakers and the Dwarf Athletic Association of America. So everything's starting to shape up great. We start to make up flyers. We're passing out thousands of flyers. And then a friend of mine knew Dickie Barrett, who was lead singer from the Mighty Mighty Bosstones. And he had a show on a radio station at the time called Indy 103.1. So I bring in Marty, this other guy, David, who I had met in the casting process of the National Lampoon show. We get in there, and we're talking to Dickie Barrett and his co-hosts, and we're having a good time. And it becomes like a rip session on me and also law enforcement in general. You know, it becomes, we're going to tear into you guys suck, cops aren't going to beat us, all this other nonsense. I'm trying to maintain some level of professionalism. But Marty's like, listen, bitch, I'm going to beat you in front of all your friends and all your coworkers. And so that's like a lose-lose. Because what do I do? Do I engage a little person in a verbal battle? Or do I just take my whooping, you know? And so, you know, I'm a man of pride. I'm like, I'm not just going to be humiliated over the airwaves. So I'm just like, listen, you little bastard, we're going to see who's going to win this. And I don't think we're going easy on you because it's war now. One of the radio managers is outside, and he's like, look, guys, that was a great segment. How about going on to our Spanish radio station and promoting the game there? One of the little people with us, David, was fluent in Spanish. So we walk down the hall, and I'm looking in the window at the radio station, and, you know, it looks like Saturday morning Mexican television. They've got rattles in there, and they're so loud I can almost hear them through the wall. They go to commercial break, bring us in. They're talking, they're doing their interview in Spanish, and all I know is, like, every 20 seconds, they're all spinning the rattles and cheering. And then I notice like the interview starts to kind of take a turn and seems to be directed more at me. And there's a lot of laughing and rattle spinning. I'm just like, okay, I don't really comprende, but I guess I changed the butt of a joke again. So I leave and David's like, man, were those guys ripping on you? And I'm like, well, why does this have to be like a bashing session? Whatever happened to friendly competition, you know? That night we're supposed to start the game. We were holding the game at Fairfax High School. I felt good because their auditorium capacity was over 500. I want to say it was closer to 750 people. So I thought, great, we've been promoting this with flyers at college campuses, on the radio. We're going to get a big turnout. So we show up. We get to the parking lot. I notice there really aren't any cars in the parking lot yet. So I'm starting to get a little nervous now, you know. The LA Breakers show up. They start their warm-up. Then some of the deputy sheriffs I know show up. These guys look pretty awesome. You know, I'm 5'11 when I stand really straight, and I was the shortest guy there. There were a couple 6'5 guys that showed up. One guy was 6'4. This is looking impressive. You know, and I thought it would be kind of a funny, witty thing to put radio and penal codes on the jerseys. You know, so we were playing with jersey 211, you know, which is the penal code for robbery, and 242, which is the penal code for battery. And I poked my head outside, and I noticed a couple people were straggling in. You know, maybe 12 or 14. You know, I see my wife there, some of my friends. They're making up most of the crowd, but it still just isn't happening yet. The people have not come yet, and it's almost game time. And at this point, I'm feeling kind of embarrassed. I'm like, I've hyped this thing. I thought I was doing something good, and it's not happening. Well, I get a call before the game starts from Marty Kleba, my friend, and he's like, Shane can't make it. And this is a big letdown to me because, you know, the whole kind of instigating factor to do this game is that Marty and I are going to have our rivalry. He's like, yeah, I got called up last minute to do some reshoots or something on Pirates of the Caribbean, and I can't make the game. And I'm like, all right, man. I go, well, you know, we're getting ready to start. And he goes, yeah. He goes, they're going to kick your ass. I already talked to him, and you're done for. You know, at this point, it's probably minutes before this game's supposed to start. We've delayed at least 30 minutes to try to pack the audience, which is now up to maybe 39 people because I counted at one point. So I go into the LA Breakers kind of side warm-up room. I poke my head in, and I'm like, all right, guys, hey, it's game time. And the guys came out, you know, God bless them. They came out like WWF wrestlers. And they were trying to get the crowd involved, and, you know, the crowd liked it, too. There wasn't a big crowd, but, you know, as we went to start the game, I remember David, the Hispanic dwarf, looking over at me saying, it's on, bitch. The ball goes up. Our center was this deputy sheriff. He's about 6'4", black guy, maybe 240 pounds. I mean, it wasn't even close. You know, he tipped this ball to us without even really looking at it, I think. And so we bring the heat. We're hitting nice outside shots. We're running. I think one of our guys slam dunked at one point. The moment of truth has come for these little people. We got caught up a little bit in the beginning with bounce passes. It's a hard adjustment to make. And not getting a rebound until the ball hits the ground, that's a little strange as well. Halftime, we go into the locker room, and I could tell kind of the vibe of the gym was definitely against us. You know, I think the audience definitely roots for the little people. When we started the second half, we went out there, and David, the little person, came up to me, and he goes, hey, man, he goes, you know, we're supposed to win this tip-off. We can't really win a tip-off with a guy who's 6'4", so when the ref goes to blow the whistle, we're going to take the ball and start running. And I'm like, ah, totally get it. You know, Harlem Globetrotter style, I dig it. We'll throw you guys a bone, you know, and this will be fun. That's how the second half starts. Crowd loves it. And the little people, they start upping the intensity. They're playing tough against us. But look, we're dealing with a team that, you know, I inadvertently put together, which is full of college-level basketball players who are now deputy sheriffs. These guys play other law enforcement agencies around the world, and they're good. So as I'm on the sideline, the captain of the little person basketball team, the Breakers, comes up to me and he goes, listen, Shane, he's like, dude, we're supposed to win. He's like, you guys are crushing us. And like the whole gimmick behind this is that we win the basketball games. We beat the regular size people. And I'm thinking to myself, what the fuck is this guy talking about? Like, I've been getting hammered and heckled for a week prior by these guys, and now I'm supposed to let them win? So I sat there for a second. And I thought, well, of course I'm supposed to let them win. I'm like, I'm playing basketball against dwarfs, and I'm supposed to let these guys win. And I'm such an idiot. I had failed to see this at this point, you know? This is essentially the Harlem Globetrotters of little people, you know? And you don't beat the Harlem Globetrotters or kids cry that night. So I pull the team over, and I go, hey, guys, listen. We got to throw the game. We're supposed to lose. So they say to me, well, what do we do, not shoot? And I'm like, no, we can shoot, but let's shoot from outside. Let's throw up some bricks. We take the court for the fourth quarter, and we start throwing up just atrocious-looking shots. And I kid you not, every shot we throw up is landing. every shot from half court, from the sideline, every shot that you would never dream of shooting is sinking, and they're all for 3 points. At one point, my buddy throws up a shot from our area, and it sinks. And he's looking at me kind of like, I'm sorry, dude, I've never made that shot before. So we're expanding our lead by double digits now, and I'm telling the guys, I'm like, quit shooting, man, quit shooting, you know? So the intensity is increasing. The dwarfs are getting more agitated. They're playing harder. They're starting to foul us. We're starting to foul them just to try to get them to free throws. And I feel like the crowd's starting to turn on us. You know, and this great idea that I had to play these little guys and raise some money is slowly becoming like a nightmare. We won by, I want to say, close to 35 points. And I didn't know whether we should celebrate. The LPs kind of glared across the court to me and said, hey, good game, wink, wink, F you, Shane. I think they'd had like a 16-game winning streak or something until that point. You know, the people in the crowd, I think, were a little confused. I don't think they expected this regular-sized team to beat up these little people by 35-plus points in a charity basketball game. I get some dirty looks from the women that were working the concession stand because I think they sold all of like $18 in food sales that night. I went up the street, and I'm sitting there, you know, hours later up at Barney's Beanery, and I get a call from Marty Kleba, the guy who did the show with me. And I pick up the phone. I'm like, hey, Marty. And he says, hey, you're a I said, we tried to lose. I said, we beat you accidentally. And he said, accidentally, my ass. You beat these guys by 35 points. And I'd been drinking at this point. I felt like I'd taken a week's worth of abuse. And I said, hey, listen, Marty, I said, maybe if you guys had brought your A game, you wouldn't be in this position. Well, Marty hung up on me. You know, last time I checked, the LA Breakers had not played a lot since that game. You know, part of me thinks that I had something to do with killing that team that night. And so at the end of this event, you know, I had a failed pilot with Marty that never took off. At least 10 players from a little person basketball team that were pissed at me. And just over a half a box of canned goods and clothing for victims of Katrina. Don't hate the player, hate the game. Don't hate the player, hate the game. Don't hate the player, hate the game.
But what if you ain't a no player? Don't hate the player. Shane Conrad is an actor, writer, and producer here in Los Angeles. This has been Unfictional, produced and hosted by me, Bob Carlson. The music supervisor is Dan Wilcox, host of his own program every Saturday night at midnight on KCRW. Plus, I had a lot of help this week from Darby Maloney. You can stream this program and find links to more information at our website, kcrw.org/unfictional. And while you're there, you can leave a comment about today's episode. If you do like the show, please tell your friends about it. We're on most Tuesdays at 2:30 p.m., repeated Fridays at 7:30 p.m. Plus, now the show is on Facebook. You can go to facebook.com/unfictional and like it. You can always podcast the show, too, at our website or at iTunes. We'll be back with a new show in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll join me then for Unfictional on KCRW and kcrw.com.